In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
You betcha. Time to talk movies. Alan Adams from The Main Edge joining us for Pass the Popcorn. Hello there, Alan.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Happy Monday to you.
And to you as well.
The weekend, I hope, went okay for you.
Yeah, it was all right. It all kind of runs together at this point. So, did get out. Did some little bit of out and about Christmas shopping, which was, I'll be honest, it was weird. Like I haven't really been inside places much over the past 17, 18 years. I don't know how long it's been. It's been a long time. But I will say there were a couple of places I popped into that really seemed to be going out of their way to make sure that everybody was as safe as possible, and that was really nice. The folks at Rock and Art Shop are doing a wonderful job, and Jabron and the folks at the Briar Patch. We actually did one of the appointment browsing appointments.
Oh, nice.
There last week, I think, or the week before, and that was great. It was just nice to be in a place and looking at stuff and just being like, and just forgetting about how terrible everything is for a hot second. It was nice. But yes, there are people out there who are really doing everything within their power, and it's nice to see.
And I find, and I haven't been to a lot of places, but did a couple things over the weekend, and I found that the pandemic doesn't really change my Christmas shopping style, which is generally to keep my head down and get in and out in less than 5 minutes.
Yes. Yes. I'm not, I've never really been a lingerer when it comes to stuff like this anyway. So it's just like, you just keep it moving.
Right.
In and out. And especially if you have a pretty good idea of what you're looking for when you turn up, it's pretty easy to get in and out. And the reality is, now more than ever, I think business owners appreciate that, because that's they can only have so many in the place at a time, and so you get in and out, that's another body walking through.
There you go. Now, you also managed to see a trio of movies this weekend. Where should we begin?
I did. Let's start. We'll start with Sister of the Groom. Now, this movie, it's available on video on demand. And it stars Alicia Silverstone and Tom Everett Scott. It's written and directed by a woman named Amy Miller Gross. As you can probably guess from the title, it's a wedding movie. I've found that these sorts of movies tend to be like pretty hit or miss. I get the impulse. Like, I understand why you want to construct a story about a wedding or around a wedding. Like, there's a lot of emotional energy sort of built into the premise, and you've got room to go in whatever direction if you want to make it slapstick and goofy, or if you want to keep it straight faced and dramatic. And it's a reason for a lot of people with varying degrees of familiarity with one another to be in one place at the same time. So I get it. I get why people keep making wedding movies. But when you sit down to watch one, you're never really sure what you're going to get. This one is on the positive end of the wedding movie spectrum. It's not without its faults, but it's more good than bad. Like, it's got some solid lead performances. The ensemble's pretty game. It succeeds more than it fails. I'll put it that way.
Okay.
But, anyway, so the deal is, Audrey, played by Alicia Silverstone, she's about to turn 40. She's struggling a little bit. She's self-conscious because her body never bounced back from giving birth to twins. She's having a tough time finding her way back into the workforce. She stepped away. She's an architect, because people in these movies there's always an architect who stepped away when she had kids. Her husband, Ethan, that's Tom Everett Scott, he's supportive, but there's just a little bit of the spark has gone out of the marriage. Now, they're on their way to Long Island because Audrey's younger brother is getting married. His name's Liam, played by Jake Hoffman, Dustin Hoffman's son. He's a real estate developer, and he's marrying an aspiring French pop singer named Clemence, played by Matilda Oliver. And they've had this whirlwind romance, and they're getting married. And the event is taking place at the former home of Audrey and Liam's parents. Their mom passed away a couple of years ago, but their dad is still around. They show up at the place, and it just immediately gets weird. Like, Audrey gets on the wrong side of the temperamental Clemence, and the situation is exacerbated by Audrey being stressed and insecure. There's this combativeness there that just escalates when Audrey starts to learn of their plan to basically raise the property. You know, again, to be fair, this is her childhood home, to raise it for a complete redesign, despite the fact that she had done a design for a renovation that's being just ignored. And it gets worse. She keeps running afoul of her future sister-in-law at every turn. They get stuck in a terrible room. She finds out that her ex-boyfriend has been invited to the wedding. And there's all this complicated stuff. And, you know, there's an overheard secret that might derail the wedding. And then Audrey decides to take some drugs that Clemence's shady brother offers her. And then, you know, well, the choices get even more questionable. We'll say that. Look, if you want to argue that Sister of the Groom could basically be called First World Problems the movie, like, I'm not going to fight you on it. It's very much a movie about well-to-do people dwelling on issues that matter very little in the grand scheme of things. And it has this sort of streak of self-involvement shot through it, this kind of narcissistic vibe in which almost all the major players are just sort of clueless as to how their choices actually impact other people. And again, like this, when you have this many me first characters, like, you could easily go off the rails pretty easily, but it's handled pretty well. Like, Gross has a really good ear for dialogue that rings very true and finds ways to sort of take her characters right up to that edge of being unlikable, but only pushing them over it when it's absolutely necessary. And again, that's a dangerous game, because if we don't sympathize, like, it all falls apart. But again, it more or less pays off. The performances are great. Like, Alicia Silverstone is lovely. You know, she's one of those people that I feel like kind of got short shrift from Hollywood in a lot of ways. I think she's talented. I just think for whatever reason, the choices that she made and the offers that she was given just never really clicked for her. Tom Everett Scott's great. Jake Hoffman, like, looks like his dad, which is weird. It's weird to see him, like, do stuff because he does look so much like his father. But he's quite good. Like, I mean, the ensemble's really solid. It's got its charms, like, even when the characters are kind of being unpleasant. Some good jokes, big feelings, you know, everyone's got, you know, we all have moments of selfishness, and this movie kind of shows what happens if too many people have them at the same time. So it's, you know, it's uneven, it's pretty lightweight, but in the end, like, it's a wedding you won't regret having attended.
All right, that's number one. What's up next for us this afternoon?
Okay, so let's talk about Greenland. Now, this is one of those movies that is it's a simultaneous theatrical and VOD release. So this is currently screening in theaters. This is very much a theatrical, intended as a theatrical release. We've had some fun at Gerard Butler's expense over the years. You know, he's made some strange choices. You've got the Blank Has Fallen trilogy. You've got the bizarre genre movies like Geostorm and Hunter Killer, something like Gods of Egypt, which I feel like I've blocked out of my memory. Like, that's a hell of a resume. But I've always found enjoyment in these movies precisely because of those flaws. Like, and to his credit, like, Gerard Butler has kind of carved out a niche as the guy you call to star in your nonsense movie. Like, he's good at it. Like, he has this ability to generate sort of an unearned gravitas. And it really sort of elevates projects that otherwise would obviously sink like a stone to the very bottom of the sort of direct-to-video seas. Now, this one, Greenland, it's a perfect example of the sort of B-movie sensibility to which Butler's kind of hitched his wagon over the last 10 years or so. But it's better. It's better than what we usually see from him. Like, it's a straightforward sort of end-of-the-world movie, but it engages on a sort of individual level. Like, one, it's a movie that embraces its budgetary limitations, and so we get a movie that's heavier on the human element than sort of CGI pageantry. Now, don't get me wrong, it's not a great movie. I mean, it's Gerard Butler we're talking about, but it's fun. And it also manages to find some moving parts despite the general outlandishness of it. So here's the deal. Gerard Butler plays John Garrity. He's a structural engineer in Atlanta. He's very good at what he does, but his personal life is in chaos. He's separating from his wife, Allison, played by Marina Baccarin, but they're still trying to work things out for the sake of their son. His name's Nathan. He's played by a young man, Roger Dale Floyd. He played young Danny in Dr. Sleep, and he's a very very talented young man. But outside this family drama, the world is consumed with news about a recently discovered and rapidly approaching comet. Now, this comet, it's named Clark, and word is that it's going to pass closer to Earth than any astronomical object in recorded history. Like, it's going to be so close that it's going to be visible during daylight hours. But as the days pass, the forecast starts to shift. First, it's going to pass us completely, and then, like, a few of the fragments are going to evaporate in our atmosphere, and then maybe some small pieces are going to actually reach the ground. But officials all over the world are adamant in ensuring the public that everything's under control. So John has gone shopping to get supplies for his kid's birthday party. He's got his son with him. And he gets this weird text message. It's a presidential alert. This alert is followed by a phone call where he gets this robotic voice that tells him that he and his family have been selected to go to a military base where they'll be transported to shelter.
So he's freaking out.
He's confused. So he goes home. He finds his wife and his neighbors. They're all there for the party. They're in the living room. They're all watching TV so they can watch what is predicted to be a harmless ocean impact of the first fragment of this comet. Instead, what happens is it hits Central Florida and annihilates everything for, like, miles around. Like, the shockwave, like, actually reaches their house in Atlanta. Like, hundreds of thousands of people are gone. And now he has to come to terms with the fact that it wasn't a joke. Like, this is an actual thing that's happened. And so he and his family, they embark on this journey, trying to make their way to safety. But as you might anticipate, there are a lot of people out there who have interests of their own. And it turns out that getting to safety is going to prove a good deal more difficult than they even could have imagined. And so we're basically in a race against time before the extinction level impact that is looming arrives. And so we're left to wonder, are they going to make it and join humanity's survivors, or will they be wiped away like so many others? Look, it's really pulpy, like good old fashioned, like pulp fun. Like, it's a film that sort of, It looks at the end through a micro lens rather than a macro, if that makes sense. Like, we're not watching the people who are trying to save the world. Like, we're with people who are just looking to survive. And so we get glimpses of the collapse that this sort of thing would probably prompt, both sudden and gradual. But it's pretty judicious as far as the effects are concerned. Like, it uses them more as storytelling tools than the crutch that you sometimes see in these big-budget sort of action apocalypse movies. Now the director, he's worked with Gerard Butler before. Like, he directed the last X Has Fallen movie, and so the two of them are comfortable together. And you can see some hints. His previous life, Wall was a stunt performer in a lot of familiar. Like, basically, if you watched an action movie in like the late 80s and early 90s, like, he was involved. And so you see a little bit of that in some of the more action oriented moments. Although there were kind of not really that many of them, depending, you know, considering what kind of movie this is. But yeah, it's real, like, meat potatoes filmmaking. Like, it's a B movie to be enjoyed on its merits rather than ironically. And again, plot's thin, gets really thin in the final act. Like, if you stop to think about any of this, you're gonna have a lot of questions. But the great thing about it is almost all exposition is delivered through these news reports on TV or radio or whatever. And so you get this nice shorthand that eliminates the kind of exposition dump explanatory sequences that you sometimes get in this kind of movie. We don't need the science, so we don't get the science. It's just like quick hit segments viewed through like a media lens. And again, I've talked about Gerard Butler's tendency to basically be like an anthropomorphized wad of dough. But he's better here. Like he's good when he's either a weirdo loose cannon or like a desperate man protecting his family. And so he's the latter here. And he also is using his own accent, which is nice. And he's pretty good. Baccarin gets more to do than the wife usually does in this kind of movie, and she takes advantage. And the supporting cast has some really talented performers. Scott Glenn turns up for a couple of scenes as Allison's dad, and we get a great turn from Hope Davis and David Denman. They carry sort of a subplot as a couple that has some questionable motivations. Like I said, not a great film, but way better than I thought it was going to be. It's got some focus, it's engaging, and it really takes some time to address what it might mean to have to navigate the end of the world. And again, doesn't all make sense, but doesn't have to.
All right,
go
end up
the ride.
And finally, we wrap it up with a much anticipated film moving from stage to screen. How was Ma Rainey's Black Bottom?
Oh, Rich, what a good movie this is. Like, you know, and we've talked about this before, like transitioning from stage to screen can be tough. Like, doesn't matter how good a play is, like, or how brilliant the writing or the writer, like shifting from live performance to the realm of cinema, like there are pitfalls all over the place. And so finding ways to make it work can be tough, but when it works, man, whew, does it ever work? And this one works. George C. Wolfe directs. The perfect pairing of director and material. He got his start in the theater. Like, he's someone who really grasps the differences between stage and screen. It's based on August Wilson's play of the same name, and it is just electrifying, Rich. It's powerful. It's provocative. The performances are just exquisite. Viola Davis is the titular Ma Rainey. And it's just a mesmerizing turn from the late Chadwick Boseman. The period aesthetic is on point. The music slaps, and it's great. And it has this wonderful sort of underlying story about appropriation and what it means to push back against that appropriation, about using your talents to force your way into the conversation, demanding a place at the table despite what the world believes you may or may not deserve. Systemic racism, cultural exploitation, and the ways in which you might choose to deal with those realities. It's just magnificent. So the basic gist is, it's the year 1927, and there are a few bigger stars in the world of black music than Ma Rainey. She's known colloquially as the mother of the blues. She's a legendary performer, sells out shows all through the South, bringing her unique vocals and daring sensuality to stages large and small. But she and her band are scheduled to cut a record at a studio in Chicago. Now, the band turns up right on time, most of them anyway. You've got trombonist Cutler, played by Coleman Domingo, the pianist Toledo, played by Glenn Turman, and the double bassist Slowdrag, named by Michael Potts. Practical dudes, guys who appreciate the fact that they have a gig and they're grateful to work with an icon like Ma Rainey. And then you have the late-arriving Levy, played by Chadwick Boseman, just a tremendously gifted and tremendously arrogant trumpet player. He sort of views Ma's songs as less than, calls them jug band music, and believes that his own abilities as musician and songwriter will only be fully appreciated when he leads his own band. Meanwhile, Ma's manager and the studio owner are waiting for her to show up, and she's not the least bit concerned about being on time. But eventually she shows up with her nephew and her girlfriend in tow, and immediately proves to be every bit as much the diva as her talent would indicate. She's making big, small demands regarding the recording session and refusing to budge on a single one of her expectations. And all the while, the boys in the band are downstairs rehearsing, but Levy's arrogance and entitlement really start to wear on the other three. Like, even in the brief moments where he displays some manner of vulnerability, he's irascible and unwilling to entertain the thought that anyone might know better than him. The other guys, older, wiser fellas who have a much more nuanced understanding of the world, are sort of equal parts amused and irritated by the attitude. Emotions rise, Ma and her band look to record some of the songs that have made her so legendary. Throughout the process, the tension remains. Some inappropriate interactions start bubbling to the surface, and you know, the beat goes on. I'm not going to spoil it because there's a lot that goes on, particularly in the third act of this, that we really shouldn't spoil. But yeah, exceptional movie.
Excellent.
Probably one of the best I've seen this year. Like, just a masterful, masterful piece of filmmaking. And again, like, I'm going to say this, it's also very obviously an adaptation of a stage play, and I mean that as a compliment. Like, August Wilson was a genius, and the Pittsburgh Cycle is one of the monumental achievements in the last 50 years of American theater. Like, by all means, show this work to as many people as possible. However you need to do it, do it. And having someone like Wolfe, who has clearly invested and connected in the material, really allows it to translate to the screen. And you've got this wonderful minimal space. So much takes place in just two rooms in a single building, you know, which is, you know, springs from its stage origins, but it really allows the ideas and the characters to assume full control. And it's almost heartbreaking how good Chadwick Boseman is in this movie, Rich. It's brilliant, and it's an indication of just how ready he was to show everybody what he was capable of. Like, swaggering and crude and combative, just strutting and wrapped up in his own talent, and it's just captivating from the moment he's on the screen to the moment he leaves it. And that's not to downplay, like, the work that Davis does in, because she's immensely talented as well, and she really goes for it, really captures, you know, this sort of aging diva, stubborn, blousy, and broken down, but still magnetic, like, challenging charisma, and just brashly elegant, and the ensemble's great, and it looks wonderful, and the dialogue is crackling, and just, like, it's just great, like, capital G great. Like,
excellent.
Intimate, intense, and just phenomenal.
Looking forward to seeing it later this week. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Check out all of Adam's review. Alan Adams reviews. Or is it Adam Allen? I get confused. All on the Main Edge. And we'll talk with you Wednesday, Al, and find out what's in the paper this week.
Yeah, let's have a chat.
I look forward to it. Thanks, Al.
Thanks, man.